Now let's move on to the subject of pluralism or relativism. To put that in colloquial terms, aren't all religions equally valid? What we might call spiritual relativism. Aren't all religions equally valid? Well, the definition of spiritual relativism is the popular belief that all religions are equal expressions of spiritual truth. You know, today there are roughly 5,000 religions on earth. Some say more, some say less, but just a multitude of different religious perspectives and religious expressions. And the relativist argues that, you know, it's kind of arrogant for one religion to step forward and say, actually, all of those are wrong and our view is right. You know, it's impossible for one view to have a monopoly on spiritual truth. And they think that it's actually bigotry, arrogant, abusive to step forward and say, you know, our view is the way. We have to ask ourselves, you know, is this really that bad of an idea that all religions are equal? You know, we do value the idea of equality, that people are equal. Shouldn't all religious views be viewed in this capacity? Here's the way leading pluralist John Hick describes it. This is from his book, A Christian Theology of Religions. He was a former evangelical Christian and shifted in his thinking to become a pluralist or relativist. He says this on page 82. He says, it, God, which he calls the real. He doesn't like calling it God. It must speak of an ultimate transcendent reality, which is the ground and source of everything. So God exists, but it, or whatever you would call it, is beyond everything and the foundation for everything. But which in its inner nature lies beyond the scope of our human conceptual systems. So he's saying, I can't quite describe the real, or it, or God, or whatever you want to call it, because it's beyond all of our abilities to conceive. This reality, which I've been referring to as the real, writes Hick, is differently conceived and therefore differently experienced and therefore differently responded to from within the different world religions. So different religions approach this transcendent reality, whatever you want to call it, and they express this differently because none of us can actually come to know this fully, only partially. In his book, he gives the example of Joseph Jastrow's duck and rabbit. He says, you know, some people, when they look at this drawing, they see a duck. Okay. Other people, they see a rabbit. And, you know, it's just your opinion, whether you see it one way or someone else's opinion, whether they see it another way. We could also look at a picture like this. He doesn't use this in his book, but some people see a young lady with her chin turned away, looking away from the camera. Other people see an old lady getting a nice profile shot with her big fur coming up over her chin. Other people, when they see this picture here, they see two old people about to kiss each other or whatever. Other people see two Mexican guys with a guitar, some cerveza, and they're singing and they're being merry with each other. You know, there's just two different ways of seeing the same picture. And to say, you know, that picture only is two old people about to kiss each other, or it's only two guys playing the guitar drinking beer, well, that would be arrogant. It would be arrogant to say that. Well, Hick writes this. The rainbow, he gives another example. The rainbow, as the sun's light refracted by the Earth's atmosphere into a glorious spectrum of colors, is a metaphor for the refraction of the divine light by our human religious cultures. So we all see one part of the rainbow, but no one could claim to have the whole thing. Here's what Jonathan Sacks, the chief rabbi of Great Britain, writes. He says there's a fundamental difference between God and religion. God is universal. Religion is particular. We serve God, author of diversity, by respecting diversity. So God is universal. He's absolute. He's real. And yet religion just sees a chunk of him. No one could actually claim to have the full down payment of who God is. And, you know, God wouldn't want us all to be that way anyways. Sachs writes, God no more wants all faiths and cultures to be the same than a loving parent wants his or her children to be the same. We will make peace in this troubled world only when we realize that God loves difference, and so at last must we. And we could add on, relativists like Sachs, like Hick, also say that if you believe you have the truth, that's going to lead to bigotry, hatred, and abuse. It's going to lead to the Spanish Inquisition. It's going to lead to forced conversions. It's going to lead to actually demonizing other religions, characterizing them differently and looking down on them. So before we look at this view, I hope I've represented it fairly. That's spiritual relativism. The view that none of us has all of the spiritual truth. Well, before we look at the claims of relativism, we need to make one quick caveat. Okay. What we're arguing against here is not social relativism, but spiritual relativism. Or to put that another way, we're not arguing against sociological relativism. We're arguing against metaphysical relativism. Social relativism is the notion that every person should be able to choose what religion and faith that they want to adhere to. That we should accept people of other religions, that we should love people of other religions. Well, the Bible teaches that. Jesus said in Matthew 5:44, he said that we should actually not only love people of other religions. He said we should love even our enemies. He didn't say that we should agree with our enemies. You know, if the Roman Empire was coming down and torturing Christians, he didn't say that you should believe in torturing Christians. He said, but you should love even your enemies. Paul said that you're supposed to return evil with good. So social relativism, that everyone can come together and believe what they want, that's biblical. What we're denying here is spiritual relativism or a metaphysical relativism, that really all views are equally true or all views eventually lead to God. That's what we're denying here. Well, I'd like to give you seven reasons why thoughtful people should deny spiritual relativism. I'd like to give you seven reasons why thoughtful people should be suspicious of spiritual or metaphysical relativism. Well, the first reason is that relativism is not biblical. Isaiah 45:5, we read, I am the Lord, and there is no other. Besides me, there is no God. So in this chunk of scripture, God's looking down at the earth. He's saying, there's no one else up here besides me. There is no other God except for me. Matthew 7:13, Jesus Christ said, enter through the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is broad that leads to destruction, and there are many who enter through it. For the gate is small, the way is narrow that leads to life, and there are few who find it. According to Jesus, there are not many roads that all lead to God. Actually, many roads lead to death, lead to separation from God. Then Jesus says in John 14:6, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. No one can come to God except through me. Jesus is making an exclusive claim there. Acts 4:12, Peter agrees. He says the same thing. He says there is salvation in no one else, for there is no other name under heaven that has been given among men by which we might be saved. So Isaiah said it. Jesus said it. Peter said it. And Paul said it. 1 Timothy 2:5. There is one God and one mediator between God and men, the man Christ Jesus. There's one God, one mediator between God and men, the man Christ Jesus. There's one way to God, not many. Now, if you're here with us tonight and you're still trying to figure out what you believe, I just want to applaud you for coming out to this class. I really respect you for coming out and trying to figure out what you think about spiritual things. I will admit that this first point is probably not that strong for you. You know, you could add this probably to the other things you don't believe in the Bible. However, if you do believe in the Bible, if you are a Bible believer, this should give you pause. This should make you wonder. You know, the same Bible that says that we're saved by grace through faith apart from works, the same Bible that says love your enemies, the same Bible that says treat others as you want to be treated, the same Bible that says take care of the poor among you, is the same Bible that says there's one God and there's one way to God. Now, who are we to approach the Bible and just start picking and choosing the things that we like and leaving behind the things that we don't? I'm sure you could see, if you're a Christian, you have to take the whole composite. You wouldn't be able just to take parts or pieces. Well, that's reason number one. Reason number two is that relativism is contrary to other realities. Let's try and apply a relativistic view to other areas of the world and see how it works. Let's apply it to medicine for a moment, okay? Imagine if a relativistic doctor said this: oh, well, whatever you think, Ralph, I'm sure whatever prescription you pick will work just fine for your advanced melanoma. Whatever prescription I pick? Well, yeah, it's just your opinion. I don't want to give you my thoughts on it. You know, I'm sure whatever pill you pick is going to help you with your cancer. Okay, what if we applied relativism to the academic world? Imagine if a kid came home and he said, Dad, you know, I feel like Columbus landed in 1992 rather than 1492, but can you believe my professor had the audacity to tell me I was wrong? Would you ever want to be a relativist when you sit down to take the SATs or the ACTs? How many scholarships do you think you would get if you just think, you know, all answers are correct? What if we applied relativism to the scientific world? Imagine if a professor at a university said, you know, some people believe that the world is flat, while others believe that it's round. What do I believe? Well, I'm convinced that they're probably both right. Who am I to say that one is right and the other is wrong? You know, how long would a science professor at a major university be able to keep tenure with a view like this? That just all perspectives on scientific truth are equally valid? We wouldn't want to be arrogant and say that one person's right and one person's wrong. Well, what if we apply it to the legal world? Imagine if a child molester said this to a judge: yes, Your Honor, but in my view, child molestation is a beautiful expression of love. I don't feel like anything is wrong with it. You know, the legal view of the court is just your opinion, not my opinion. You know, how long would a child molester be able to last on a view like that? I wouldn't want that guy being able to get out of the courtroom alive just based on that defense, especially if his beautiful expression of love was toward a kid I knew. In the legal world, there is such a thing as right and wrong, and we can adjudicate between the two perspectives. As a guy told me recently, he said a guy came up to him and he said, you know, how can you believe that there's only one way to get to God? He said, well, just imagine if you walked into a city, you're driving through a city, rather, and you pulled over and you asked a stranger, you know, hey, I'm trying to get to Chicago. Could you give me directions? And, you know, and the guy turned to you and he said, well, you know, whichever road you pick, I'm sure it'll be fine. Whichever road? I don't think you understand. Should I get on the interstate? Should I go north, south, east, west? No, all roads get to Chicago. Don't worry about that. You know, you'd probably never want to go back to that city ever again. You'd think those people were really jerks in that city. They told you that. Well, let's ask ourselves a very important question. If relativism doesn't work in any of these parts of the world, why would we ever expect it to work in the spiritual world? You know, why would we ever use a framework or a lens for understanding truth when approaching God that we would never use on our job, with our family, while taking a test? You know, what if you're driving down the highway and a cop pulled you over and he said, you know, you were going 100 in a 60 mile an hour zone. And you said, well, actually, that sign that said Interstate 100, I interpreted that to mean the speed limit. And, you know, it's just your interpretation that that sign is referring to an interstate. You know, we would never use this criteria for truth in any other area of life. This is blind faith at its worst. At least, at the very least, the relativist has to give us a reason why they think all paths would eventually lead to God, because we don't see this criteria anywhere else. Let's move on to our third reason. Relativism is self-defeating. It's self-defeating. Since we already discussed this subject, you're familiar with what a self-defeating statement is. We'll be able to unpack these pretty quickly. Take, for example, this statement. It is impossible for one worldview to be right. Okay, isn't relativism a worldview? If it's impossible for one worldview to be right, wouldn't this negate relativism from being right? Wouldn't it mean that it's impossible for relativism to be true? Take this statement. You can't make universal truth claims that universally apply to everybody on Earth. Really? You can't make universal truth claims that apply to everybody. You just made a universal truth claim, and now you're trying to apply it to me. That's what you're saying. If we can't make universal truth claims, then what you're saying is that's just your subjective opinion. We could put that another way. You know, you say you want everyone to have their own view, but it really seems like you want me to be a relativist and adopt your view and abandon mine. Or to put that another way, you say that nothing is universally true, but you seem to be saying that your view is universally true. Self-defeating. Here's the way that Paul Copan, a philosopher in Florida, Palm Beach Atlantic University. Look at that nice suntan he's got. Florida. He says this in his book, True for You, but Not True for Me. Quote, if claims are only true to the speaker, then his claims are only true to himself. It is difficult to see why his claims should matter to us. Oddly, the relativist is unwilling to relativize his relativism. If relativism is really true, then why wouldn't you apply that to your own view? If you're saying that relativism is universally true, then you're no longer a relativist. You're an absolutist, like everyone else. What about this statement? Christianity might be true for you, but it isn't true for everyone. Well, here's a question. If my Christian belief is only true for me, then why isn't your relativism only true for you? What about this statement? It's arrogant to say that someone else's worldview is wrong and your worldview is true. Okay, by saying that, you're contradicting what Christianity teaches. Aren't you saying that Christianity is wrong? By definition, wouldn't this make your view arrogant? Unless you're saying that Christianity is really true. In that case, you're defeating your own statement. Copan writes this on page 24. While a worldview can be internally consistent or logical, yet still be false, no worldview can be true if it contradicts itself. You see what he's saying? He's saying you could have a system of belief that's internally consistent. The Lord of the Rings, J.R. Tolkien, went to pains to have an entire universe that's internally consistent. And yet, it's not true. I'm sorry to break that to you. It's not real. The idea that Santa Claus sees you while you're sleeping and knows when you're awake, that he rewards kids, that's internally consistent. Makes sense. But it's false. So a system could be internally consistent and yet be false. However, if a system contradicts itself, it is by definition false. It can't be true. We could also point out here, this isn't just some truth test we're talking about. It's at least that. But in addition to being internally inconsistent, I think we would be right in saying that relativism is dishonest. You're basically saying the same thing that the Christian is saying, only you don't want to make an exclusive truth claim. It's hypocritical to say that. It's hypocritical to do that. To basically make a claim that everyone else is making, but trying to disguise it as though that's not really what you're doing, even though you are. Number four, relativism is illogical. Relativism is illogical. Let's take that law of logic, one of many, the law of non-contradiction. Two contradictory truths cannot be true at the same time. A cannot equal non-A in the same way, at the same time, the same place. Okay, let's apply that to God. If all religions are equal expressions of who God is, well, wait a minute. Some religions teach that God exists by definition. Others teach that he does not exist by definition. Atheism, and classical forms of Buddhism, or actually agnostic faiths, that there is no God. So how is it possible for God to both exist and not exist at the same time? That can't possibly be true. Some religions and worldviews say that God is the sum of all moral value. Others say that God is non-moral or amoral. Wait a minute. How can God be both the sum of all moral value and non-moral or amoral at the same time? Some religions say that God entered human history as the definition and the proof for their faith. Others say that it's impossible for God to enter into human history because he's impersonal. How can God be both personal and impersonal, enter human history and not enter human history at the same time? You know, we use this logical law every time we decide to leave a room and we walk through the door rather than through the wall. Okay? We believe in laws of logic everywhere else. Why wouldn't we apply this to God? Why wouldn't we just obviously assume it's impossible for God to be logically contradictory things at the same time? You know, we could think of Mother Teresa and Adolf Hitler. Mother Teresa and Adolf Hitler both believed in progress. They both used the same word, progress. But wouldn't we all admit that they're speaking of different types of progress? In fact, logically contradictory types of progress? Would we say that they were both moving toward the same end? Absolutely not. In the same way, we could both use the term God, G-O-D, and yet we could be talking about radically different things. If God was this way, let's say God actually did reveal himself to the 5,000 different religions on earth in multiple ways and in multiple disguises and in multiple views. At this point, we would be safe to conclude that God has a multiple personality disorder. Okay? He's contradicting himself in his revelation. Well, here's the question. Do you feel like a God like that, a God who is the relativistic God, is capable of governing over our universe? Do you feel like a God like that is capable of governing over your life? Why would you trust a God like that, who's telling different things, speaking out of both sides of his mouth? The fifth reason why we should be suspicious of relativism is that it denies revelation. It denies revelation. I remember in my freshman year, before I was into Christ at all, I remember sitting in a sociology class back in Akron U, where I grew up, got my undergraduate. And the sociology prof gave this illustration. And the illustration was this. She said, you know, all religions on earth, from a sociological perspective, they're kind of like four men walking into a room with an elephant. And they all have a blindfold on. They can't see. So the first guy comes up to the elephant, and he's got a blindfold, and he wraps his arms around the big, stolid leg of the elephant, and he feels its coarse skin. He's blindfolded. He can't see. So he says, I think what we're feeling here is a tree. Well, the second guy walks up. He grabs the long, slender tail of the elephant, and he says, a tree, you idiot. Clearly, it's a snake that we're feeling. The other guy jumps up on top of the elephant. He's feeling the big ears of the elephant. He says, a tree? A snake? You guys are both fools. What we're feeling here is a bat with large wings. And then the fourth guy is off in the corner. He's feeling the wall. He's not anywhere near the elephant. And so he says, a tree? A bat? A snake? You know, there's actually nothing in here. We're not feeling anything. You're all deluded that there's even an animal in this room. And so, from this old Hindu parable, we might conclude that all the different religions of the earth are the same way. You know, we're all violently arguing with each other on which view of God is right. But none of us have the complete picture. And to sit here and argue is really just nonsense to do that. Well, I remember even back then, that illustration really bothered me. And it still does today. I'd like to give you a few reasons why that illustration does not add up. First, First, this does not prove that all religions are true. This illustration proves that all religions are false. Do you see the distinction? The first guy comes up and he grabs the leg. And what's he say? It's a tree. He was wrong. It's an elephant. It's not a tree. Second guy thinks it's a snake. The other guy thinks it's a bat. The other guy thinks it's nothing. All four of these observers are wrong. They were incorrect. Not that they were all true. The way that agnostic philosopher Bertrand Russell describes it, this is in his book, Why I Am Not a Christian. He says, it is evident as a matter of logic that since the great world religions disagree, not more than one of them can be true. So either they're all wrong or one is right, but they can't all be true. That's just from an atheistic perspective. The second reason why this illustration doesn't make sense is that it doesn't actually prove relativism. It proves the idea of revelation. Now, we just turned that on him. How did we do that? Well, what this shows is that we have a need for revelation. I remember talking to one guy in a hookah bar, and he gave me this illustration, and I said, I think that's actually a good illustration, but it illustrates my point, not yours. So how do you figure? I said, well, who's the narrator of that story? He said, I am. I don't know. I'm telling you this story. I said, I know that, but if this thing actually happened, if there was an elephant in a room and four blindfolded men, who's the narrator of the story? Surely it's not one of the blindfolded men. Then who is it? He said, well, it must be a fifth guy in the room. I said, well, what's different between him and the other men in the room? He said, he's not wearing a blindfold. I said, that's right. What if you had another figure in the room, no blindfold on, and he's watching this whole thing? The narrator, by definition, would have to have his blindfold taken off. Which brings us to a third reason why this illustration doesn't add up. It actually shows the importance of why we should share our faith in the elephant with other people. Could you imagine being in that room? The one guy's grabbing the wings or the ears, he's saying it's a bat. The other guy's saying it's a tree. The other guy's saying it's nothing. Could you imagine tiptoeing through that room, trying to get out of their way, trying to get out of the disagreement? Wouldn't it be a loving thing to do to say, hey, I'm here. I can see it's an elephant. You guys have blindfolds on. You need to take them off. I'm one who can actually see. Well, to push that illustration a little further, if you were holding on to the leg of the animal and you had a blindfold on, you might think that guy's lying. You might think you're full of it. You have a blindfold on just like the rest of us. It would take a step of faith to believe that other guy, to believe that that was actually true. But what if you could get to a point where your blindfold could be taken off? Well, this is just the claim of the Bible. The Bible teaches that Christians are not better or worse than other people on earth. All it teaches is that we know God because God revealed himself to us. As the blind man put it in John 9:25, he said, I used to be blind, but now I can see. And of course, that sign in John 9 was symbolic of a metaphysical truth that Christ was trying to teach. One more point we could make here is that relativism claims to have the very thing that it denies in others. This is why I said earlier that relativism is hypocritical. It's not just self-defeating. The relativist is claiming that they are the ones in the room that can tell this story about four blindfolded men trying to perceive the elephant. They think they know who the elephant is. They think they have a proper diagnosis on all the other men in the room. Relativists, who by world population probably represent less than 1% or 2% of people on earth, look out at all the religions on earth and they're basically saying, you silly religious people, if only you became a relativist like us, you would be able to have truth of who God is and why all these problems in the world are the way that they are. That's the exact same thing that the Christian is saying. They're saying God has revealed himself to us. We think we know who God is. And we think that if this view was spread across the world, that that would bring solutions to the problems in the world. would actually bring love and joy into people's lives. So they're actually saying the exact same thing that we are, only they're being dishonest about it. They're being hypocritical about it. Number six, relativism trivializes religion. It trivializes religion. Well, how do you figure that? How does relativism make religion trivial, or maybe we could say meaningless? Well, it substitutes the ultimate being of God with any being. You know, for years, people, philosophers and thinkers, referred to God as the summum bonum, the supreme good, the greatest conceivable good. And they talked about who God was and trying to discover who God was for centuries and millennia. Well, that search, that discussion and dialogue toward an ultimate being under relativism has been replaced with any being. Okay, imagine if someone came forward and said, okay, you believe that there's a God who's loving and personal and cares about you. Well, I believe that my God lives in this porcelain toilet bowl in my bathroom. So you're saying that your view is just as equal as his view, her view, and his view? So we're saying that spirituality is actually being lowered down to the point where it's not just some different views, but actually any view makes it in. That would mean that spirituality is lowered down to the point of human feces. We're saying that this object of our worship could be even that. I hope that doesn't sound rude or anything, but under this view, there would be no way to distinguish one view from another. You could see this wouldn't raise spirituality at all. In fact, it would lower it. It would make it trivial and meaningless. Well, so far we've looked at different reasons why relativism isn't logical, okay? But I think right now what we should do is look at reasons why it's not loving either. It's not only illogical, but it's actually unloving to hold to this perspective. That brings us to reason number seven. Relativism is unloving. If you're anything like me, if you're like-minded with me at all, then you probably hate what most of religion has done. Think about the Ku Klux Klan, a Christian terrorist group arising from America. They believe that based on Genesis 9:24, that African-American people are actually under the curse of God. That's how badly they've misinterpreted the Bible. And they're on a campaign to eliminate African-American people from this country. Those are very spiritual people who do that. They have serious spiritual convictions that they're adhering to. And you know what? I don't think that's true. I don't think that's real. I think they're false in those beliefs. And yet, if you're a relativist, on what basis can you say that that's not right? Why isn't that just another equal expression of spirituality? You know, we could think about the practice of Hindu sute, where a woman throws herself alive on her husband's funeral pyre. Well, why do they do that? Well, the goddess Sati threw herself on the pyre of Shiva, her husband. And because she made that complete sacrificial act, women voluntarily or by coercion were thrown onto their husband's funeral pyre when the husband passed away. But if you're a relativist, you have to look at Hindu sute and say that's an equal expression of spirituality. Think about the cult groups. Here's a picture of Jim Jones's cult back in 1978. Jim Jones led a mass suicide of 918 people. People killed themselves. Some people were murdered because of this cult. We can also think about Marshall Applewhite's group, 1997. They drank the poison Kool-Aid. He convinced 39 other people that if they drank this Kool-Aid, they would die, but their spirits would go behind Hale-Bopp Comet and hop on an alien ship that would take them to a paradise across the other side of the universe. I don't think that's true. I think if a friend of mine was going to join a revived version of Heaven's Gate cult, I would tell them, don't do that. That's a load of bull. They're lying to you. There is no spaceship out there. There is no planet that you're going to go to. You're just drinking poison Kool-Aid. But if you're a relativist, are you prepared to bite the bullet and say that these different perspectives are equal expressions of spirituality? I don't think that's loving. I think if you're willing to be consistent with that perspective, I think that's an unloving worldview to have. And Christianity has a basis upon which we could say that's false, not true. We should not believe that. We should not fall into the peril, the disgusting trash of what religion has brought on this planet. Well, those are our seven reasons why relativism should be suspicious to thoughtful people. But someone might be thinking, you know, well, what's the solution? What's the solution? Maybe relativism isn't true, but what could replace it? You know, it's not fair if you just beat down on a view without actually giving an adequate replacement. Well, I think whatever the worldview is that we adopt should answer two questions. The first question is the view actually true? Is it actually real? And the second question is the view going to bring love, joy, peace, patience, and kindness to the hurting world around us? Is that the view that we're going to adopt? Not only is it true, but which view is actually going to help this dying and hurting world around us? I think if you found a worldview that answered those two points, that would be a pretty robust, favorable worldview. You know, you ever think about how most of the great men and women throughout history were fundamentalists? I don't mean fundamentalist Christians. I just mean fundamentalists. They believed in objective truth. Okay? They believed in something beyond themselves toward which they should lead their lives. You know, if you're a relativist, if you don't believe in an objective truth beyond yourself, why get up and put your pants on in the morning? Why go across the world to help people who are hurting? Why go and help the poor? Why try and make a difference if every culture just has their own view and that's their perspective? Why care? Instead, what we see when we look through history is that the people who made the most amount of difference, the moral reformers, the revolutionaries who cared for people, they actually believed in objective truth, not subjective truth. We can also point out that we live in an era of globalization. Today, our world is seeing multiple competing worldviews trying to dominate our world around us. We would live in a pipe dream if we think that everyone is going to stay in their divided ideological hub without trying to influence others. That is a time of the past that is gone. We're moving toward a state in human history where multiple ideologies are competing in our world today. That's the reality of our world. Well, the question is, which ideology should be the one that we should adopt? Which ideology is going to bring love, joy, and patience to the world? Well, this is the way Matthew Paris describes it in his article from the Sunday Times. The name of the article is, "As an Atheist, I Truly Believe Africa Needs God." He's a self-proclaimed atheist, and he's a journalist as well. This is what he writes in the article. Quote, "Now a confirmed atheist, I've become convinced of the enormous contribution that Christian evangelism makes in Africa, sharply distinct from the work of secular NGOs, government projects, and international aid efforts. These alone will not do. Education and training alone will not do. In Africa, Christianity changes people's hearts." This is an atheist writing this. He says, "It brings spiritual transformation. The rebirth is real. The change is good. Those who want Africa to walk tall amid 21st century global competition must not kid themselves that providing the material means or even the know-how that accompanies what we call development will make the change. A whole belief system must first be supplanted. And I'm afraid it has to be supplanted by another." He's just saying it's a pipe dream to think that multiple views are not going to surge into Africa. He says removing Christian evangelism from the African equation may leave the continent at the mercy of a malign fusion of Nike, the witch doctor, the mobile phone, and the machete. So what we have here is a guy just observing, you know, which view is actually going to help people in need? Which view is going to be able to spread across the world and bring love? You know, to put it simply, the Bible teaches that God gives an isolated group of people the truth, not so that they can suppress other people, but so that they can bless other people. Here's a list of scriptures. These are just from the Old Testament. Okay? When God first set up a nation in Israel, repeatedly he went out of his way to say, you know, I'm setting you guys up here, but the point is not so you can suppress the nations around you, not so that you can be proud and arrogant and look down at other people. The point is so that you can be a blessing to the world. It goes all the way from Genesis all the way until the end of the Hebrew Bible. And of course, in the New Testament, many of us are aware that Jesus said that we should go to the ends of the earth, that we should not bring God's love to an isolated group, but that all nations should hear about the love of God. What are some conclusions we could draw here if you're trying to figure out what worldview you should adopt? I'd just like to ask you a question. Do you want to find a worldview that can bring love, joy, and patience into your life? Do you want to find a worldview that talks about the love of God, how he cares about you, how he died for you, how he did the absolutely unthinkable for you? You know, other world religions teach some form of works, that we have to work our way to God, whether that's the Eastern perspective where we become more and more enlightened, that's on our end, or it's the Western faiths that just teach we have to be more moral, more loving, keep adhering to the law. All other worldviews teach that it's our view, it's our end, the ball's in our court to deal with our separation with God. Christianity is completely 100% different. Instead of working our way to God, the Bible teaches that God actually worked his way to us. He gave his one and only Son so that we could be made right with him. And all we would have to do is believe in him, receive his gift of forgiveness, and we would be set straight with God. Well, that view, if believed, ruins the idea of self-righteousness. You know, I've met some Christian people who are self-righteous. I don't really like them. I don't like to hang around them. But I would say that there's a difference there between them and self-righteous people in other worldviews. The difference is they're contradicting what they claim to believe, that they have some kind of righteousness in and of themselves, which the Bible doesn't teach. Dwelling on the love of God brings love and joy and patience into your life. That could have a radical effect on you if you chose to adopt this worldview. Do you want to find a worldview that can bring love, joy, and patience into the world? Are you the kind of person that actually cares about the needs of others, that wants to make a difference in other people's lives? Do you want to find a worldview that can help you deal with religious people, wacky, you know, cult members, aberrant religion, destructive religious teaching? Do you want to find a worldview where you would have the basis to say, you know, I love you, I care about you, and that's why I'm saying you're wrong. Don't agree with this. Don't agree with this aberrant, destructive path that you're taking. Well, if you want to find a worldview like that, I would just encourage you to carefully consider the Christian worldview. You should at least give it a chance because it is robust and has an ability to impact people. Well, let me just pause there for questions. Do we have any questions? Yeah. Well, I guess I wouldn't say that we want to coerce someone into believing something that they don't like just to make them feel like everyone's on the in crowd or something like that. But I would say if your tendency, if your direction is toward to help people, to hate aberrant religion and to have a basis upon which you could denounce that and yet still be loving, I guess I would just say that why wouldn't you adopt the Christian worldview because it is more robust. It has an ability to actually do the thing that you're already desiring. I think it's more consistent with what they're believing.